This is the current federal tax developments for the week of July 2nd, 2018. Current federal tax developments are brought to you, as always, by Kaplan Professional Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, broadcasting again from Phoenix, and we'll be bringing you the updates of what's gone on this week and other issues that have arisen here in taxes for this week that begins on July the 2nd. This week, we're going to start with discussing the IRS's new e-postcard for Form 1040 that was released at the end of the week. We'll also discuss a CPA that advised an ESOP, basically an employer and an ESOP on their plan, prepared the 5500s, and then also did the appraisal, and how this time, the third time this particular accountant was in court on this issue, he actually prevailed and was not found to be not independent. The IRS published a list of qualified opportunity zones. We haven't had a chance to discuss those here before. We'll discuss what those are and how they're impacted and the, you know, the kinds of things your client's going to be asking about those zones as we go forward. We'll then end up with a couple of procedural cases. One that takes a look at, can you, if you amend a tax return and the original return had a fraudulent position, does that reduce the fraud penalty? And then the second case of a taxpayer who thought they had agreed to end an audit with no penalties, but discovered that they had only agreed to complete the audit, accept the adjustments with some penalties waived, but the IRS hadn't mentioned others. So we're going to discuss all of that here today. But let's start out looking at this interesting development we have from the IRS, the new postcard Form 1040. And that draft was released this week. That particular form, we have a draft Form 1040, which to much, you know, much fanfare, we were told that this 1040 is now a postcard. Remember that? That's been the goal for years, is to be able to file your taxes on a postcard. So Congress now claims, hey, guys, we've accomplished that now. And I shouldn't say Congress at this point is. The Treasury Department says, well, Congress gave us this new law. And you know what? Because of that, we now can file our tax returns on a postcard. Okay, may not be quite as good as we think, but let's start out. The actual Form 1040 has been greatly reduced. In fact, it now is basically two half pages. I know we're calling it a postcard, but realistically, nobody's going to mail in a tax return on a true postcard. So this thing's going in envelopes regardless of what you might think about it. The first page is just basically, you know, taxpayer's name, their dependents. We only have room for two on that front page. That's kind of interesting too. Apparently more than two dependents. One needs to have extra postcards, I guess, is the way it'll work. We'll see how that all runs up. You have the signature block and the paid prepare signature block, and that's pretty much it for the front of the return. The page two is where the numbers reside these days, and only a few of them. We're now down to what is 23 lines, which actually is much a smaller number than we've had before. And, you know, a number of those, as far as income goes, the only types of income listed on this form will be wages, salaries, interest, dividends, IRAs, pensions, and annuities, Social Security benefits, and that's all that you can put on the front page of the one of the 1040. Rather, then we go to this line six, and this is what starts all the fun. It turns out that how we got rid of all these lines is we moved them on to six schedules. Okay. These schedules have lines. They were taken from the old 1040. So you're going to find all these lines. If you go to the various schedules, you'll attach them. If you actually look at the form, we've got the links for you on the website as to where you can find these actual IRS forms. The PDF with the articles this week will show you pictures of the forms. You know, they were released. And by the way, if you saw the initial leaked versions early in the week, last week, it did change minorly when we got to the final release version. So there are very minor changes. But basically, if you saw those, I believe the first ones I saw came out on the New York Times website. And once they were leaked to the Times, they ended up being leaked everywhere. So tax analysts had them. I saw them in the Wall Street Journal, various other places. You've seen these forms. They're not that different from the leaked forms. So we'll run that down. We'll do that. You know, that number six gives us basically all the old income. And that's kind of what you have to understand. There are six schedules. The first schedule that you have here on this form, our first schedule, has additional income and adjustments to income. Okay. That's the form. It really has all the stuff, all the income lines they got rid of that used to be on the front page of the 1040, and then all of the adjustments. So basically, the front page of the 1040 is now, far more of it is on Schedule 1 than is on the 1040 anymore. What used to be our front page. The Schedule 2 is a computation of various special taxes. Now, not all of them, but like the tax on unearned income for the child, lump sum distribution tax, if you still have those, the AMT, advanced premium tax credit, those go on here. This schedule, interestingly enough, has lines 38 to 43 that are reserved. So we apparently plan to do something with them, but hasn't been decided yet how it's going to work. Schedule 3 is all the non-refundable credits. So these are our traditional credits like the foreign tax credit, child dependent care credit, all the education credits, the residential energy credit, the child tax credit, non-refundable portion. All of those things go on this form, Schedule 3. Schedule 4, this is where we find all the taxes that didn't end up on Schedule 2 and aren't on the front page of the 1040, or the second page, I guess we say, the 1040. That includes things like the self-employment tax, the additional Medicare tax, the tax on net investment income, all of those sorts of things. Household employees tax goes on here. Those are all part of your Schedule 4. Schedule 5 has all your payments and credits and other refundable style credits with a few minor exceptions. The earned income credit, for instance, does have its own box on page 2 of 1040. Also, withholdings from wages or withholdings from anything also have their own box. But if you pay estimated tax payments, you're going to need to file Schedule 5. Schedule 5 is where we're going to report those things. And then a number of other credits and taxes. Schedule 6 is fairly straightforward. It just has, if there's a foreign address, you know, you put that in there. And then the third-party designee, where the IRS can call and talk to you if they have questions, that's moved off the main form. It's now back here on Schedule 6. So if you normally provide that for clients, you normally have clients, you know, clients normally sign off and say the IRS could ask you about the very limited number of things they can ask you about. That Schedule 6 is now, that's not going to be part of the new Schedule 6. The plan is for these forms to be used on the 2018 tax returns. So the theory is we're going to look this way. Now, a couple of comments I have about this. First, it's quite obvious, and most commentators have pointed out, that this really didn't simplify anything. In fact, arguably, it probably made it a bit more complicated because now we're going to have a front page form and carrying numbers from other forms. But understand, it was meant to achieve the long-stated political goal of having a tax return on a postcard. Now, I realize most of us thought that meant that we'd actually simplify the tax system down, so we didn't need 6 schedules to go with the postcard, along with all the other schedules we've had before. But, you know, hey, obviously the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act didn't get there, so they're just going to force it this way. Secondly, most commentary that I've seen on this from most sources has not exactly been positive, shall we say, so far. Most of us in the tax professions are saying, who cares? It's either A, this really doesn't matter because the vast majority of taxpayers electronically file these days, so they don't really have this to fill in. Or it's been that, you know, they don't really change. You have to simplify the law. It's not the form, it's not the problem, it's the law. Nevertheless, the Treasury Secretary believes this is a good thing, and a couple of people with the Treasury have been the ones primarily tooting its horn. Interestingly enough, this past Friday, the president did talk about the new tax law, talked about the benefits of the new tax law. But interestingly enough, even though they were releasing these forms on Friday, he never mentioned these forms. So right now it appears outside of Treasury, doesn't appear like there's a lot of thrill for these forms. But, you know, we'll wait and see. We'll see if it actually becomes something that people like. My guess is it'll become something people just don't notice after a while. But remember, one catch for those of us who do a lot of reviewing of tax returns, though, is obviously we've got to get used to remembering the schedules we should be seeing now, in addition to a very shortened form of the 1040 itself. Next up, we're going to have a case that dealt with an ESOP plan. This is the case of Val Lane's Recreation Center Corporation versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2018-92. This case was decided on June the 26th. This is an interesting case. This involves a case of an ESOP. And in this case, the CPA in question, who, by the way, passed away after giving testimony in this case before the case was decided, the CPA had advised the client, you know, you really should set up an ESOP. Went ahead and said, actually helped them get it qualified, went through the qualification, got the termination letter. And finally, every year was preparing the 5500s for the ESOP. The CPA would also prepare every year. This CPA had prepared the appraisal for the ESOP. Now, initially, to be totally honest, if you're going to kind of, you know, handicap this case initially, you would probably have decided that maybe it didn't look so good. Why? Well, because this particular CPA had been before the tax court twice before with two other ESOPs. And in both cases, they found that he did not meet the independent appraiser requirement. Now, it's not simply to be an independent appraiser. We need to be aware of that requirement of the ESOP found at 408A28C basically says that you've got to be an independent appraiser. Okay. But they said, for purposes of this sentence, independent appraiser means an appraiser meeting the requirements similar to those under the Section 170 for charitable contributions. Now, we have some other rules in the reg that tell us what independent should mean, but they're very simple and statutory. The catch in prior cases had been that this particular CPA had failed to state his qualifications in the appraisal. That's one of the things that's required. They also discovered other issues with those ESOPs in the other two cases. In this case, though, the judge hearing this case decided that, A, the CPA had learned his lesson, and now we did have those recitations of his qualifications. We did have information about, you know, his qualifications. He had information otherwise. The court did find that he did a lot of appraisals, that he generally was known for doing them. They found they presented evidence that he did this regularly. So the IRS was down to using what had been effectively, in a previous case, a comment in passing where they had said essentially, you know, that in the Churchill case, which was a prior case that had involved him, that, well, you know, because he was so deeply involved with the ESOP, it doesn't appear to us that he was an independent appraiser. Okay, that's fine. We don't think he was independent. IRS said, well, you know, he's got the same relationship here. Therefore, we believe that he is truly not independent. Well, this court said, look, that statement in Churchill, the court, when the tax court decided Churchill, they ultimately did not rely on that statement to disqualify the ESOP. The court said, so effectively, what the court was saying was, in Churchill, that was a statement that's sometimes referred to as dicta. That is, dicta, taking a definition here from WEX on the Cornell University Legal Information Institute website, a dicta is a statement of opinion or belief considered authoritative because of the dignity of the person making it, the court in this case. The term is generally used to describe a court's discussion of points or questions not raised by the records, or suggestions of rules not applicable to the case at law. Okay. Judicial diction is an opinion by the court on a question that is not essential to its decision, even though it may be directly involved. What the court said was, we're not going to say that we're disagreeing or saying Churchill was decided wrongly. Rather, we're going to say this whole thing didn't matter in Churchill. This time, we covered all the other bases. It does matter. And in this case, the court held that, in fact, the CPA was not automatically not an independent appraiser merely because he had done work to put the 401k plan together, or not the 401k, the ESOP together. He had actually gotten the termination letter, and he had been the one preparing the 5500s. The court said, nope, that's not enough. Merely being in that position was, at least in the opinion of this judge, not sufficient to make you not independent. Now, we do need to point out one thing. It's a tax court memo decision, and so was Churchill a memo decision. And we had two different judges. Not to me totally clear that, in fact, you know, we're going to find that you'll get a consistent result on this issue going forward. Just be aware. but it's definitely an interesting case. And certainly, at least it gives some support if you have a case where the CPA or some other provider had also been doing the appraisals and other services. You may be able to get out if those services aren't directly related and, you know, you don't otherwise violate directly the regulation, which he did not. Next up, the IRS issued this week a notice, or actually last week, notice 2018-48 on June the 20th. They issued a list of opportunity zones under 1400Z-1 of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So we have a nice list of these things. These are tax, what the opportunity zones, and this is qualified, designated qualified opportunity zones. And there's a real neat advantage here for taxpayers. It was set up by Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. We haven't really discussed it here before. Taxpayers who do this, if they sell property at a gain, and within 180 days, they reinvest that gain in a qualified opportunity zone fund, that capital gain will be delayed, deferred. Okay, has to be to an unrelated third party, but we sell that, we pick up this gain. So I go ahead and I sell a bunch of marketable securities, generate a $140,000 gain. Within 6 months, I can turn around and invest those funds in one of these qualified opportunity zone funds. If I do that, that entire gain on that sale of securities is deferred, right? It essentially reduces my basis, basically, in the opportunity zone fund investment I just made. But it gets even better. If you hold it long enough, slowly, we get to tax-exempt gain, right? If we hold it over 5 years, the basis in the deferred gain, which starts at zero, is increased to 10% of the deferred gain. If you hold it over 7 years, we increase another 5%. And if we hold the investment for more than 10 years, we can elect to have the basis of the property set as equal to its fair value at the time we sell it. So not only do we have a deferral opportunity, but if we can hold on for 10 years, we've got utterly tax-free income. Sounds great. Well, what's the catch? The catch is you have to invest in these opportunity zones. The states provided a list of these areas for IRS approval. This was meant to encourage investments in areas that are considered blighted, don't get investments people aren't interested in for various reasons. So we put these together. We certainly are seeing this done. The IRS has now gone through that list submitted from the states. They have published in Notice 2018-48 their list of qualified opportunity zones for which the credits will be available. Your clients, therefore, should now start being seeing, and we've actually seen these now being pushed to clients, where they can go into these opportunity zone funds and do these investments. The question is, should they? Well, if the investment works, okay, the underlying investment, ignore the tax side of it for a little while. If the underlying investment works, the tax benefits are huge, okay? Total wipeout of any recognized gain if we stay in for 10 years. Certainly, at the very least, a deferral of our gain that we recognized on selling stuff to go into our opportunity zone. And even then, and partial turning that tax-free if we don't hold for the full 10 years. Wonderful option. But here's the thing you got to recall. There was a reason why people weren't investing in these areas before, right? Now, maybe it's just that people didn't see the opportunities there, and this will turn out to be a great thing. But I also expect there are going to be some really bad dog investments in some of these things that just aren't going to work nearly as well. So fundamentally, you need to make sure the client understands that the tax benefits of this will not offset what's just a bad investment from the start. So taxpayers need to make sure that they actually are getting into funds that they really want to be in. That's probably the best takeaway from this. But if you've not looked at these, this is 1400Z-1. Yes, we've gotten so many code sections now. We've not just started adding cap letters at the end. We've now do cap letters and dash numbers. We got -1, -2 here. -1 is a definition of what these zones are. Dash 2 is where you're going to find the tax benefits. If you haven't looked there, I suggest you take a look at those because, yeah, they do offer some real benefits. Next up, the case of Gaskin versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2018-89. This was decided on June the 20th. Now, in this case, a taxpayer was fighting the IRS because the IRS was trying to impose a fraud penalty on the taxpayer. And in fact, the taxpayer had already conceded in criminal cases that essentially his original return was fraudulent. But he prepared and submitted an amended return. Now, the problem, of course, is with the fraud penalty under Section 6663A. If any part of an underpayment is due to fraud, there is a 75% penalty added. So if you fraudulently admitted income that saved you $100,000 in tax, you'd owe the $100,000, you'd owe the penalty, you'd owe the interest, and you'd owe an additional $75,000 in penalties. Now, this taxpayer, seeing that, hey, you know, things probably aren't going to turn out well, he decided that he would file an amended return. Now, amended returns under Regulation 1.6664-23I provide generally that if you have a qualifying amended return, you get out of a lot of penalties. But when you take a look at this, you'll discover that one of the penalties you don't get out of is the fraud penalty. You know, does not apply. 1.6642B relief does not apply to fraud. It does apply to the standard 6662 penalties for accuracy-related issues. So you solve that problem. That's your benefit for coming forward voluntarily as opposed to waiting for the service to contact you. If you voluntarily do it before the service contacts you, you're fine. Now, obviously, this taxpayer would have some issues with whether he voluntarily came forward, but the court said it's really irrelevant. The fraud penalty is blocked. You cannot get relief or reduce your fraud penalty by later amending the return. And by the way, that would be true even if a taxpayer had filed a fraudulent return, then IRS criminal investigation people, nobody's shown yet. They just had second thoughts, decided shouldn't do that. They amend the return. That would also not relieve them from the fraud penalty. So it's important to understand what does and doesn't work in this area. Okay. Key issue, though, does not work for fraud. Next case where also the taxpayers didn't get a result they wanted. This is the case of Hinkle versus United States from the District Court of New Mexico, case number 1:16-CV-01048KG/SCY. It was decided on June the 16th of 2018. Excuse me, but I'm having a bit of a cough today, so working my way through this. The taxpayer in this case had an exam. Exam was now being completed. The agent had completed his proposed assessments. He'd given them a draft 4549. That draft 4549 had provided for imposition of penalties under 6662 for a substantial understatement of tax. The taxpayer, their representative, had discussed this with the IRS, and they said, well, you know, okay, we can kind of agree with that assessment, but really, can't we get rid of those penalties? Question you may ask. The agent in the case said, okay, we can get rid of those 6662 penalties. And so I'm going to get rid of all the penalties on this thing. All those penalties will go away. You know, as long as you go ahead and you sign an agreement stating that you relied upon, you know, your tax advisor who told you this was okay. And they said, yes, they signed that. Now, they believe that they had an agreement to, you know, agree to this assessment, and the IRS had agreed there'd be no penalties. But about a week after they signed the 4549, accepting the IRS's, IRS's tax changes, they received a notice that the IRS was looking at them for penalties under 6707 Cap A. That's a penalty for failing to disclose a listed transaction. The IRS position, of course, is going to be that this was a listed transaction. And as such, they should have had disclosure on the return, which they didn't have. That missing disclosure ends up costing you up to 75% of the tax that was saved with certain maximums and minimum penalties. Well, wait, they're saying, hey, wait, Fal, your agent told us that we were agreeing to these changes on the return, and you had agreed we weren't going to have any penalties. And it added to the confusion because it was a back and forth with correspondence. And at one point, the IRS has said, yes, you know, we look back at your files when you're asking for a waiver of this penalty. And we discovered that all the penalties related to the 13 return had been waived per your agreement with the agent. The taxpayer said, hey, court, this is unfair, right? We signed a 4549 that closed it with no penalties. The IRS should not be allowed now to come back and now start saying, oh, yeah, there's this 6707A penalty that we want to assess. Well, the court took a look at this situation, and the court came down with two key findings. Number one, the court pointed out that a 4549 does not represent a final closing of all issues. You have to get a formal closing agreement, which you almost never will get in an exam context, you know, absent some really hard pushing and some really good reasons. So that the IRS was perfectly justified in coming back later and imposing these penalties, right? If you want to really lock them down on a contractual basis so that you have a contractual agreement with them that they won't impose penalties, you have to get the formal closing agreement. That was not done in this case. Therefore, there is no contractual block. The court then said, well, there could be an estoppel block. In essence, it could be that because you were given some information by the IRS that you relied upon and that turned out not to be true, that, you know, we basically should be able to come back and say, well, you know, you relied upon it. It's not really going to be, you know, realistically, even though it's not a contract, equitable estoppel says the IRS can't come back and do this. But the court pointed out that equitable estoppel is not allowed very often in tax matters. And if it was going to be, here's the four things you had to show. That the IRS must know all of the facts, including, you know, all the facts of the case. There's no facts they weren't aware of. Well, the IRS probably knew those in this case. That's not a problem. The IRS must intend that its conduct will be acted upon or must so act that the taxpayer has the right to believe it was so intended, so that the IRS did that. Number two pretty much requires affirmative misconduct by the IRS to mislead you. Okay. The taxpayer must be ignorant of the true facts of the matter, and they very well may have been ignorant of the fact that, you know, this other penalty wasn't covered by this. And the taxpayer must rely on that bad conduct. The court said the problem in this case was they don't see any affirmative misconduct. They said all the evidence established was that the IRS agent on the exam had come to you with an assessment that showed 6662 penalties. You had talked with the agent. You came to an agreement that, you know, with this assertion from your side that they'd relied upon the advisor, that the penalties on that 4549 would be taken away. There'd be no penalties there. Those penalties would be gone. The IRS never brought those penalties back. 6662 penalties never came back on the return. The IRS never actually made a statement. They said, well, what about that letter that said we'd waived all penalties? They said, well, that letter was clearly referring back to 4549. These were the 6662 penalties. And secondly, that occurred after you had already had your supposed, you know, action taken on reliance. That thing, maybe if you had it before, you'd actually sign the 4549, where they said your agreement waived all penalties. Maybe that might make sense, that letter. But that letter didn't come till later, so you clearly didn't rely on it. And finally, you know, you should not have assumed, given the wording of the protection the service was giving you, what they were saying you wouldn't be penalized for, it should have been clear that they were only talking about those 6662 penalties This penalty for failing to disclose on the return is a separate item, a separate issue, and the IRS is perfectly okay with going forward with it. Therefore, the court allowed the IRS to go forward on this. As always, I want to remind you, this is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs. Be sure to take a look in their catalogs and on their websites for courses coming up. Current Federal Tax Developments, as always, is brought to you here each week on this, you know, in this location, wherever you're seeing it, be it on our video, be it the audio, be it coming from your State Society. Be sure to catch our regular updates during the week on our website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you have any questions or comments during the week, you can send them to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Ed Zollers, and I usually follow discussions on the Tax Pros group on Reddit. That'll be at reddit.com/r/taxpros. Also on the California Society Tax Talk site, I'll take a look there. That again is on Yahoo Groups. You go to the Tax Talk, look for that as a group, apply to get in. You should get in. Those of you in Arizona, I also frequent the Arizona Society's listserv. Well, you know, we've got our simplified tax form now. We've got Wayfair. It's been an interesting couple of weeks. We'll see what comes up next week, and hopefully you'll be back here to join us for another week as we talk about issues arising here in current federal tax developments.